I believe we exactly finished chapter 2 and did not start chapter 3, right?
Yeah.
So that brings us to chapter 3 then, which is a chapter devoted to the specialness of water. I already said that water is a special chemical in a lot of ways. And if it weren't for that specialness, no life would have evolved. I'm going to go through the various things that make it special, but all these different things that we'll talk about really all come from the fact that water is polar. And so let's recall what it means to be polar. We've already discussed this, but remember, polar molecules, well, first of all, molecules in general, when I use that word, what does that mean? What am I talking about? What kind of compounds if I say molecules? Right. Covalent compounds form molecules. Ionic compounds form crystals of indeterminate size, right? But the smallest one is the formula unit. Okay, anyway, we're talking about molecules here, covalent compounds. And any given individual covalent bond can be either polar or nonpolar, right? What is it that makes it nonpolar? What has to be true for a covalent bond to be nonpolar? Okay, let's back up one piece then. What does it mean to be covalent? Yeah.
Borrowing one of the electrons, basically?
Well, I think a better word is sharing.
Yeah.
Right. Each of them is borrowing one from the other. So there's a pair of electrons that are shared in a covalent bond, which is what makes it much stronger than an ionic bond. They're both chemical bonds, right? It changes the stuff you have, but much stronger if it's covalent than ionic. So, with that as the general definition of covalent bonds, all covalent bonds are sharing electrons. What is it that has to be true for a covalent bond to be nonpolar? Well, that's a result of it being nonpolar. But what is it that makes it nonpolar? Yeah.
The electrons.
Right. That sharing that has to be there for it to be covalent is equal sharing. And when that pair of electrons, because remember, a single covalent bond is two electrons. When those two electrons are shared equally between the two atomic nuclei, the two atoms that are involved in that bond, then it's nonpolar. If it's not equal sharing, but still is sharing, then it's covalent because of the sharing, but it's polar because of the unequal sharing. And the reason that makes it polar, meaning one end is different from the other in some way, is that the things being shared, the electrons, are charged particles. So if they spend more time around one end than the other, around one nucleus than the other, then that one nucleus that they spend more time around is going to be slightly negatively charged because the electrons are carrying negative charge. And the other end, which is not getting those electrons nearly as often as the other end, is going to be slightly positive. That's what we denote with the lowercase Greek delta. Delta minus indicates that those electrons are there more often, even though they spend some time around both nucleus, they're there more often than not, and the delta positive is slightly positive because this end of the bond doesn't see those electrons as often. Okay? Now, water is not the only example of a polar covalent compound or a polar molecule. But it's the one that's the basis for life, and that polarity gives it a lot of special properties. What we see represented by the ellipses here, triple dots, are hydrogen bonds, as labeled. A hydrogen bond can form between any polar molecules, but when you have just pure water, all the molecules are water, and hydrogen bonding can occur between adjacent water molecules. Now, is a hydrogen bond a chemical bond?
No.
Why not?
Doesn't change it.
It doesn't change what you have, right? It just slightly holds together water molecules. And maybe just for a tiny fraction of a second. But that force between them, that attractive force, is because one of them is slightly positive, one end of the water molecule is slightly positive, and one end of the next water molecule is slightly negative. And in order for those charges to oppose each other, to be opposite, facing each other, the water molecules have to swivel, right? So that the oxygen end, which is partially negative, faces the partially positive hydrogen of the next one. What is it? Why is it that there can be unequal sharing to begin with? What is it that accounts for the sharing in a polar covalent bond being unequal? They're cutting a deal, right, with each other. I'm going to let you get credit for one of my electrons if you also let me get credit for one of yours, and we'll both get credit for both of the ones that are being shared. That's what a covalent bond is. Why would it end up being unequal?
One's getting more than the other?
Right, that's the definition of unequal, but why would that happen? What has to be true about the two nuclei involved, the two atoms? Well, if there are two atoms of the same element, then it's not going to be unequal. They're going to share them exactly equally if there are the two of the same atom. Makes sense, right? They have the same properties. They're identical. If the two atoms involved in the bond are different elements, then it might be equal sharing, it might be unequal sharing. But what determines whether it's unequal? Yeah.
Electronegativity.
That's the important atomic property, or property of the element. And remember what the trend is. Electronegativity values go from low to high as you go from lower left on the periodic table to upper right. And oxygen is near that upper right corner. It has higher electronegativity than almost everything else. And that's why it greedily wants those shared electrons for itself. And therefore, unless it is sharing them with another oxygen atom or something else with almost equally high electronegativity, the sharing won't be equal. Hydrogen's electronegativity value is much lower than oxygen's. So yes, they're sharing, but the electrons spend more time around the more highly electronegative atom, in this case, oxygen. And wherever the higher electronegativity is, and therefore the more time spent by those negative electrons, the more the charge is partially negative. So if these were nonpolar molecules, like oxygen molecules, right? Oxygen gas is not atomic oxygen, because oxygen by itself as an atom is unsatisfied, right? Valence-wise, it is not as stable as it could be. What's the valence of oxygen? What's the definition of valence? I'm trying to convince you that you should be studying these notes every night, not putting it off until the night before the test.
So the outside electrons.
Well, those are the valence electrons.
Okay.
But what is the valence? How many additional ones it needs to fill that outer subshell, right? Which is another way of saying how many bonds it's going to make, covalent bonds, if it's going to engage in a covalent bond with something, some other nonmetal. And so what is that number for oxygen?
Two.
It's two steps away from the right edge, which represents stability, right? The right edge of the periodic table is where you find those inert, noble gases that are satisfied by themselves. So when you talk about pure oxygen gas, it's not oxygen atoms. It's oxygen molecules. Each one is O2, right? They have really high electronegativities because oxygen has among the highest. But they're equally high, so no one wins in that situation, and the electrons are equally shared. Well, when oxygen, you have trillions and trillions of oxygen molecules in a sample of gas, even a little sample, They're colliding with each other, but they're not spinning and orienting themselves because there's no partial charges. They're just encountering each other and otherwise ignoring each other. Not true with water because of these partial charges that unequal sharing brings about. And that means that a population of water molecules is going to have a little bit more order to it than a population of nonpolar molecules. Does that all make sense? And that's what brings about these special characteristics of water that we're about to start talking about with slide two. What we see here is capillary attraction. Now, capillary just refers to any narrow tube. Like a capillary tube in a lab is a tiny, very, very thin glass tube, right? And you know what I'm talking about by a capillary tube? And capillaries in your body are the narrowest of the blood vessels, which is why they're called that. But a glass capillary tube, you know, if a lancet is used to puncture your skin and you have a little drop of blood there, you just put a capillary, glass capillary tube on that droplet, what happens? The blood goes against gravity up the capillary tube and fills it, right? That's called capillary attraction. And that happens because of hydrogen bonding between the water, that which blood mostly is, and other particles. Well, between water molecules and other water molecules, and also between water molecules and other molecules, namely the molecules that are the part of the glass tubing. Biologically, you see this same thing happening in a process in plants called transpiration. Transpiration refers to the directional movement of water from the soil solution into the roots, up through the body of the plant, and then out the leaves, continuously moving. Well, notice that that is an uphill movement of water the whole way. And you can't move water uphill very easily, right? Which is why we have to have pumps to do that when we want it to happen. It's easy to get water to fall downhill, but if you need it to go uphill, you need it to force it somehow. There needs to be a force that will push it. Well, actually, in the case of transpiration, it's a pulling force. And that pulling force is hydrogen bonding that occurs between water molecules and other molecules. So the capillaries here are the tiny tube-like vessels in a tree, for instance. What you actually have within this, in these tubes, and there's many, many tubes, but just consider one tube like a long straw as tall as the tree. You really have a long train of water molecules within that tube, right? And by train, I mean, by analogy, just like a freight train made up of many, many cars all linked together, right? The links between those cars in this analogy represent the hydrogen bonds between adjacent water molecules because they're attracting each other. A hydrogen bond isn't very strong, which is why it's not a chemical bond, but it's stronger than nothing. And so if you consider this whole train of water molecules to be like a freight train, the one at the lead, at the top, is like the engine pulling the rest of them. Right? It's directly pulling on the one behind it, below it, then it's pulling on the one below it, and so on because of these hydrogen bonds. So the hydrogen bonding accounts for two different forces, cohesion and adhesion, which are really just sticky forces. They're the same thing, really, caused by hydrogen bond, but we use two different names to distinguish two situations. Co means share. So cohesive forces, or cohesion, refers to attraction between particles of the same type, between water molecules and other water molecules, for instance, in this example. whereas adhesion is force of attraction between particles of different types. In this case, between the water molecules and the walls of the vessels themselves. Yeah.
So why when you put
the trunk of the tree, is that why you see those little circles in the tree? The rings of the trunk, you mean? Like if this is the trunk, you'll see rings?
Yeah.
Those rings are 1 year's worth of new tiny xylem tubes.
So it's the tubes, but it just every year it gets more.
The reason you see them as rings is because in the warmer parts of the years, it makes more of them, and then in the colder, it makes fewer of them, and that gives them a lighter and darker appearance over and over, and that's why we can count the rings to age the tree.
And just one more time, cohesion means the attraction of the same molecule.
Right.
Adhesion is the attraction of different.
Right.
Okay.
Water's involved in both of these,
right.
But you know, if part of transpiration is when the water exits at the leaves,
right.
Where it turns, you know, where it goes into the gas phase,
right.
Meaning it's no longer part of this train anymore. Well, that leaves a space in the tube at the top, and so that now this one's the new engine, and it's being pulled up to this empty part of the tube toward the wall by adhesive forces. And the cohesive forces drag the other water molecules behind it.
Right. Okay, and then one more thing. That diagram on the far right there.
Yeah.
That's basically like, we'll say just like a little capillary tube and a tree going up, right?
Yeah, this is one tiny little xylem tube,
yep.
With individual water molecules in it. And now each individual hydrogen bond is tiny in force.
Yep.
But since you have trillions and trillions of them, they add up to a significant amount, and it's impressive how much it is, especially when you consider the largest organisms that have ever existed, the sequoia trees, which are not just large, they're tall, also the tallest organisms that have ever existed. Getting water that high without any electricity or pump, just by pulling on them with this capillary attraction, is truly impressive. I mean, it would take a lot of energy to pump it up, which is why, by the way, you know, when you're used to turning on a faucet and having water come out if you've paid your bill, why does it come out? Because there's a pressure gradient, right? Pressure is higher inside than outside, so it comes out. It doesn't go back in. But what causes that pressure to begin with? Why is the water pressurized in your pipes? No, not really. Not directly. The reason it's pressurized is because there are tanks around town holding the water higher than your house. And so the pressurization is caused by gravity. The water's falling out of your spigot because the tanks are higher than the houses. But if you build a skyscraper taller, you know, around here in the Midwest, they have water towers. Because there aren't mountains. But in places like around here, on the mesas, you find water tanks. That's causing your water pressure. But you build a skyscraper taller than that, the water's only going to go up to as high as it is in the tank. You're going to have to force it up to the top of the skyscraper with a pump, dedicated pump. And that's doing the work that just these hydrogen bonds are doing in a sequoia tree. Okay, slide 3. Hydrogen bonds are also responsible for another important quality of water, which is that it has surface tension. We can see this animal walking on the surface of the water without piercing the actual liquid. You know, it's actually stepping on the surface without sinking in. It's deforming the surface, but its legs are not actually under the water surface. And it looks like the water actually has a skin on the top that's tougher than the water below it, right? Well, it doesn't just look like that. That's actually true. Let me try to explain it just with a beaker of water. If you look at a beaker, and I'll represent the water molecules just as dots. At depth, meaning anything other than the surface at the top, the water molecules are pretty evenly spaced. I mean, they're all moving, so yes, there are some that are closer, some that are farther at any given moment, but they're pretty evenly spaced. And think about just an individual water molecule at any depth other than the surface. Because of the polarity of water, it is being attracted by all directions, water molecules in all directions. It's being pulled, basically, in all directions at once. But think about a water molecule at the very top, at the surface. It's being attracted by water molecules below it, which exist there, but there aren't water molecules above it pulling it upward. So in other words, it's being pulled down only and not in all directions. And that compresses the layer of the top molecules together more, since they're only feeling force from below. And it actually makes it a thicker piece of water there at the top, kind of like a skin, and harder to pierce, therefore. So this can happen. That wouldn't happen with a nonpolar liquid, because they don't have any force of attraction between them. Slide 4. In this map, we have a large body of water right against a large body of land. And it doesn't matter where this is specifically, you can see where it is, but anywhere you have a large body of water next to a large land mass, you have some things in common. There's a couple things going on here. One is that water, compared to most chemicals, water has a high value, comparatively high value, for what we call the specific heat capacity. Now, the specific heat capacity, just like electronegativity, any element has its own value for electronegativity. Any substance, whether it's an element or a compound, has a specific heat capacity. What is that specific heat capacity in general? Well, the definition is that the specific heat capacity is the amount of energy required to change the temperature of 1 gram of that stuff, whatever it is, by 1 degree centigrade or 1 Kelvin, same thing. So in other words, specific heat capacity is a numerical indication of how easy or difficult it is to heat the stuff up. Not all substances, you know, you can have exactly the same mass of two different substances and they're not going to heat up equally easily. Right, this is what's behind the adage, a watched pot never boils. Of course it does. It will boil if you keep watching it, but it seems like it never does because people are impatient. When you're watching it, it seems like it's going to take forever for that water to boil. And that's because water is hard to heat up. You have to heat it up before it gets to the boiling point. And it takes a lot of energy compared to other things of equal mass. Other compounds have lower specific heat capacities. And therefore, they're easier to heat up or cool down. You know, if you also, with as far as cooking is concerned, if you have a pan that's hot, you put oil in it, that oil is going to get hot a hell of a lot quicker than an equal amount of water would, because oil has a lower specific heat capacity. So that's what specific heat capacity is by definition, and there are different values, whatever the numerical value is, depending on the actual substance. Water is higher than most. And this means that bodies of water cool and warm more slowly than land masses do. Now, the energy coming in during the day is from the sun, right? It's radiant energy that's coming down on ocean, other bodies of water, and on land. And so in a given area that are right next to each other like this, this ocean is getting the same amount of energy input from the sun as the land mass right beside it. But the ocean's not going to undergo as high an increase in temperature during the day or as low a decrease in temperature during night. It's going to go up and down each day, but water's going to be more stable. The amplitude of that oscillation which is how the difference between the high point and the low point, is not going to be nearly as much as it is for land, which is going to get warmer during the day than the water and then cool down to cooler than the ocean at night. Well, this is important because you should, even though we're terrestrial animals, so we tend to think about fellow terrestrial organisms, that's only recently that organisms have been terrestrial, only within the last 700 million years or so has things lived on land. Life started in the ocean, and the ocean was the best place to start life because, for one reason, it's the most stable conditions because of that high specific heat capacity. So that's one thing. Another thing that's illustrated here, not really so much by the picture, but I'm going to talk about it in the same slide, is that water has also a high value for something that's called the latent heat of vaporization. Vaporization just refers to evaporation. And so any given substance has, just like it has a specific heat capacity, every substance has a latent heat of vaporization. The definition of that is the amount of energy required to transform 1 gram of that stuff from liquid into gas. In other words, to evaporate 1 gram of it. That's the latent heat of vaporization. Now, recall that this is a state change, just a physical change, right? It's not a chemical change, evaporation. What is the difference between a liquid and a gas? The space between the particles, exactly. Much farther apart are particles that are in the gas phase. Liquid phase, they're much closer together, and solid. Well, the latent heat of vaporization, the high latent heat of vaporization for water compared to most other things, means that when water evaporates, that requires a lot of heat, and this saves your life living here. Every year, every day of the summer, it saves your life. Because we sweat when we get overheated, right? That the sweat itself is mostly water. There's some salt in it, but it's the water that evaporates when we sweat. And because water is so difficult to evaporate, taking a lot of energy, that heat comes from our body, and it cools the body. So when water evaporates, it not only cools the water, the liquid water from which it's evaporating, it makes that water cooler. And that would also involve the skin, which is where the liquid is. But it also makes the air into which it is evaporating cooler. It makes them both cooler. Now, that might not seem to make sense, but let me explain it. I mean, you might guess that one would get cooler and one would get warmer, but they both get cooler. Well, first of all, what is temperature? It's not heat. Temperature and heat are not the same thing. Heat is the energy of the motion of the particles. Heat is an example of what we call an extensive property. Because the extent, how much of what you have matters. Temperature, on the other hand, is an example of an intensive property, where it doesn't matter how much you have. Okay? The two are related, but they're not the same. Heat is the motion of the particles, therefore the more particles you have, the more extensive mass you have, the more heat you have. Temperature, on the other hand, is an average. It's an average of the speed of the particles. Each individual particle is moving at its own speed. But if you were able to instantaneously measure all those speeds and then divide by the number of particles, you'd have the average, right? The fact that it's divided by the total number is why it makes it intensive. The amount doesn't matter. It's just the average of the population. So just in easy to understand terms, if you consider a swimming pool has so much water in it, whatever, Well, that swimming, you can take the temperature of that swimming pool with a thermometer, get a good temperature, and you could take then a glass full of water out of that swimming pool, and if you measure the temperature of that immediately, before it has a chance to change, it'll be the same temperature, right? Much less water in the cup than in the pool, but they have the same temperature, intensive property, because they have the same average speed of the particles. But the swimming pool has a hell of a lot more particles of water, more water molecules than the glass. So the swimming pool contains a lot more heat than the glass does, even though they're at the same temperature. All right, that's the difference between extensive and intensive. Now to explain why evaporation cools the water from which the liquid water from which the evaporation is occurring. Well, temperature, as I just was saying, is the average speed of the particles, right? High temperature means, on average, those particles are moving faster than something that would have a lower temperature. Okay, now, these are all water molecules we're talking about, which are polar molecules, so they're all attracting each other via hydrogen bonds, right? Now, imagine that you are a single water molecule in a liquid population. It doesn't make sense to call an individual water molecule liquid or solid or gas, right? That's only the association with other particles. But you're one in the population of liquid water, one molecule. If you are going to be one of the ones that evaporates, that means going off on your own, right? Spacing yourself well apart from the liquid and being part of the air now. What, you know, all these are identical chemically. They're all water molecules. But what are the water molecules that have the best chance of going off onto their own? Yeah.
The ones that are moving the fastest.
The ones that are moving the fastest, and also the ones that happen to be near the surface. If you're moving fast and you're at depth, you're just going to run into something. But if you're at the surface, then that gives you a chance. And among those ones that are at the surface, the ones that happen to just be moving the fastest at the moment are the ones that are going to be able to break those hydrogen bonds with the other liquid molecules and be off on their own in the air. Okay, so that means as evaporation occurs, you're removing from the liquid population the fastest of the molecules. What does that do to the average speed that are left behind? If you're removing the fastest ones from the class,
they rise up.
No, it's going to get lower. You're removing the fastest ones. That means the ones that are still in the liquid are now, on average, going to be slower, right? It brings the average down when you remove the fastest ones. Well, the average speed is the temperature. It goes down, means that the liquid water left behind is cooler, and that saves your life when you get overheated. But so does that make sense? Why? By the way, that would be true for a nonpolar liquid as well. But it would be easier for that to happen in a nonpolar liquid. The reason meaning that it would be a lower latent heat of vaporization for another liquid. The reason that it's higher for water is because one of the things impeding them from going off on their own is those hydrogen bonds. If you don't have those hydrogen bonds, you just need to be fast enough. You're not attracted to the other ones behind you. Okay, yeah.
So what happens when you're on a pool, it's like, say, if you're Alaska, for example, what happens to that?
Well, your body homeostatically is telling your sweat glands not to deliver sweat to the surface of the body, so that you're minimizing the amount of evaporation. You're still going to do some evaporation because that's not the only source of the water at your skin, but you really would like to shut off the evaporation. You can't entirely shut it off, but even in cold situations, evaporation is going to make it even colder.
So in the same sense, what if this diagram, of the temperature of the water, what would it do to the island? Like, would the temperature drop?
Well,
lower than the temperature? Because
This has to do with the second part, because we just talked about the water getting cooler as it evaporates, but the air into which those evaporating water molecules goes gets cooler as well, which is why evaporative coolers work if you have one in your house rather than an air conditioner. It's really just water continuously evaporating into the air, making that air cooler, and then you pump that into your house. Here's why it gets cooler in the air. And if that air is blowing from the ocean into inland, it's going to be cool for that reason, because it's evaporated a bunch of water from the ocean. Here's why it happens, though. The fastest ones are leaving the liquid, right? That's why it makes the liquid cooler. But even though they're the fastest ones, in general, they're not as fast as the population of particles that are already in the gas phase. That's why they are gas. They're already fast. So you're actually, by adding those, they're slower than the average ones in the air, and therefore you bring down the average speed of the air particles as well, making the air cooler. So you cool both the water that's evaporated from and the air into which evaporation is occurring. And like I said, when that happens over the ocean and then blows inland, it's cold air that you're getting rather than air that's coming from sun-baked land to, you know, well inland. And that's why you have these bands of much lower temperatures right at the coast. Okay. Another property, slide 5, is that, and there's very few things like this. Water is one of them, though. Water is an example of a substance that is more dense as a liquid than it is as a solid. It's just the opposite case for most substances. Right? We already talked about the difference between gas and liquid. It's really just how tightly spaced they are. Liquid is much more tightly spaced. Well, in solids, it's even more tightly spaced in most things. That's what defines a solid. You know, in a solid, they're not only packed together tightly for most things, but they're also no longer moving with respect to each other. They're locked in place. And that's why a solid will not assume the shape of the container it's in, right? Whereas a liquid will, because they're all slipping past each other even though they're close together. Well, in a solid, they're even closer together, but not for water. So normal substances or non-water substances, the solid state is the densest, because density is a measure of how much mass you have packed into a given volume, right? Water, though, is more dense as a liquid than as a solid. And the reason, once again, is due to hydrogen bonding. Here we have hydrogen bonding occurring in ice on the left and liquid on the right. When the temperature gets so low that water freezes, that's when they lock into position with respect to each other. Now, it still has a temperature, still has an absolute temperature, even at 0 degrees, right? That's zero is only defined as zero because of freezing of water. But it has a temperature, an absolute temperature in kelvins. So there's still motion, but it's not motion to the point of them changing positions. It's motion, they're just vibrating in place, basically. And that's what locks it into a crystal. All right. Well, because of the hydrogen bonding, because of the angles between the hydrogen and oxygen on each molecule, when water freezes, the molecules swivel into that perfect position where the partial negatives are pointed toward the partial positives of the next molecule, like you see here, making this kind of a soccer ball arrangement in 3 dimensions. And that takes up a lot of space. This is why ice, solid water, is less dense because of all that space in between. Okay? Now, when you have higher temperature, and therefore it's liquid water, the hydrogen bond still exists, but because the particles are moving faster, that's what it means that it's warmer, the speed of those particles is enough to keep breaking those hydrogen bonds. So they're trying to form, and they're trying to form into this shape right here. They just don't get a chance to do that because it's continuously being broken by the speed of these particles. and therefore the individual water molecules get closer together than they are in ice, even though they're all moving with respect to each other. So it's more dense. Now that is not only unusual, but it is important to biology. The picture illustrates this. If this were not true, if water were ordinary in the sense that that ice is denser than liquid water, which it's not, then we wouldn't be here. That's another reason we wouldn't be here. If you consider a body of water that freezes, if water were like everything else, and or almost everything else, and ice is denser, then ice formation, when it gets cold each season, that ice that forms, you know, you have some ice, you have some liquid water, but the ice being denser would fall to the bottom, right? And so you'd have frozen ice on the bottom, liquid above it. Then the season changes and it thaws out because you have more sunlight coming in. Some, but not all, of that ice would melt. You'd leave a little bit of ice, and then the next freeze on the next season, you would add ice to that. There's already some there, so you make it thicker, and then it wouldn't all thaw. And each year it would get thicker and thicker until you have a solid chunk of ice, no liquid at all. And that makes it a lot more difficult for things to live in, right? They need liquid water to actually remain alive in. Not only that, though, the way it works now with water being more dense and therefore ice floating at the top means that ice forms just at the top, right? If you ice skate on a pond, you still have water below you. That's where the stuff is living still. So it not only allows for things to live in water below the ice, but the ice itself is actually protective during that time. It keeps the water from getting even colder because ice, as it gets whitish, will reflect a lot of sunlight. And it also is just thermally insulated just because it's ice. So it, the temperature extremes that are experienced in the water part below the ice aren't nearly as great as they would be if this weren't true. And things can make it over the winter and therefore continue to exist. Okay, slide 6. Here we have a representation of the fact that water makes an excellent solvent. By excellent, I mean it dissolves a wide range, a big variety of solutes. So keep in mind the three definitions we talked about in lab. A solution is a special mixture in which one part of that thing, one component of that solution is dissolving another component. The solvent is doing the dissolving, the solutes are being dissolved, and the overall mixture is the solution. Well, water is not the only solvent. There's all kinds of solvents, but water is an especially good solvent for quite a few different things. It's not good for everything, though. And once again, this has to do with hydrogen bonding. The reason that water is a good solvent is because it's polar. But that means it only really does a good job at dissolving other polar or fully charged things, like ionic compounds. Oil is not polar, which is why oil doesn't mix with water. Water doesn't dissolve it. They stay apart, trying to avoid each other. You have a close-up here of a crystal of table salt, sodium chloride, made up of however many trillions of individual ions. Well, they're held together because of their opposite charges, right? Sodium ions and chloride ions have opposite charge. That holds the whole chunk of millions of these together. But when water gets next to the surface, it's also not only polar, but it's small. It's able to get in there and interfere with the charges because water has partial charges itself. And so it's able to pick off one surface ion at a time, and then surround it in three dimensions, not just the two that you have here. So you'll have a shroud of water molecules all the way around the chloride ion. And all of those water molecules will rotate so that the partially positive hydrogens are facing the negative chloride ion. And that keeps that chloride ion on its own, dissolved in water, because it's no longer interacting with the sodiums. Same thing for sodium, though, except that the water molecules that shroud it spin in such a way that the partially negative oxygen is facing the positive sodium. So in this case, you no longer have sodium chloride. Sodium chloride was the solid. You put that into water, you no longer have sodium chloride. You have a solution of sodium ions and chloride ions, both independently dissolved in water. And the fact that water is a good solvent really is fundamental to life, because I keep calling life metabolism, right? Life is just the chemical reactions that occur in cells. Well, all of those chemical reactions occur in aqueous solution, meaning in a solution in which water is the solvent. So life, when you really get down to it, is aqueous solution chemistry. Seven is also this same property, but this illustrates that you don't have to have salts being the solutes for water to dissolve them well. Water does an excellent job of dissolving any salts, any ionic compound, because they are fully charged, right? But certain things other than salts, other than ionic compounds, can be dissolved as well, including proteins. This big purple thing is a protein, complex molecule. Proteins are made of what monomers? A protein is a polymer, meaning that you string together a bunch of monomers to make it, right? What are those building blocks or monomers that make up a protein? They're amino acids. And we haven't discussed this in detail yet, so don't worry that you didn't know that. But depending on what kinds of amino acids are made to build a given protein, it will give... Some of them carry charge, some of them don't. Some amino acids are charged, some are not. But when you get a bunch of them together to form a protein, and it then folds up into a three-dimensional shape, which is important because that shape allows that protein to do whatever job it does. When that happens, usually you have a bunch of partial charges on the exterior surface of the protein. Some parts of it might be partially positive, some part might be partially negative. Well, water does exactly the same thing, the swivel trick. Regardless of whether a given part is partially positive or partially negative, it will swivel appropriately, like you see in this extreme close-up on the right, so that the opposite partial charge of the water molecule is right against it. And therefore, this whole big protein will be dissolved by a bunch of water molecules shrouding its entire surface. Okay, now to eight. Here we have a cartoon representation of a chemical reaction occurring that is called the auto-ionization of water. So think about what auto-ionization means. That means ionizing itself, right? Auto means self. So consider a population of nothing but water molecules. It's a pure water population. Well, here we've limited it to just two individual water molecules. But what's happening here, if you proceed from the right, notice, by the way, that this is a reversible reaction. It can go toward the right or toward the left. But if you operate this reaction toward the right, what's happening is that you start out with two neutral water molecules. Neutral means that overall the molecule is neutral because there's just as many protons as there are electrons total. That's not the same thing as meaning that neutral does not mean nonpolar. Neutral just means electrons and protons total the same number. So there's no overall charge. But how that charge is distributed can be not equal, which is what makes it polar. But anyway, no, this is not an ion, is what I'm saying. This is a water molecule that has overall neutrality. What's happening, though, is that one of the protons of the one of the hydrogen atoms is being transferred. Okay, now first of all, remember our discussion of ions. Ions form how? What causes an ion to form? Yeah.
The imbalance of electrons and protons?
Right, but how does that actually happen? If you start with just a single neutral atom, how does an ion form? Yeah. Electrons, yes. Adding or subtracting electrons. Now consider the simplest atom, which is hydrogen. What is that hydrogen atom to begin with? In terms of subatomic particles, what is it made up of? No. One proton and one electron, exactly.
Oh.
Not some number.
Yeah.
One proton is what makes it hydrogen, right? That one electron makes it a neutral atom of hydrogen. And in most in the normal case, the most abundant isotope, you don't have any neutrons, right? So a hydrogen atom is just a proton and an electron. If you lose that electron, you're losing all the electrons, right? And the only thing that is left behind is a proton. So I want you to equate these terms in your mind. Proton and hydrogen ion mean the same thing. Because when you've lost that one electron that you have, the only thing left is a proton. But they both also can be symbolized by H+. So a superscripted plus. H+, proton, and hydrogen ion are equivalent terms, interchangeable. So keep that in mind throughout the term, and for the rest of your life, actually. Now, back to this specific instance here. You have two water molecules. Well, the hydrogen atom of one water molecule is going to split into the proton and the electron that it was made out of. The electron is going to stay behind with the oxygen and the other hydrogen atom. The proton is going to now be associated with the other water molecule. Okay? And doing that forms two different ions. You don't have a neutral molecule in either case. Now you have both of them being ions, but of opposite charges. The one that the proton left from and is no longer there is now a hydroxide ion. It has the electron that the hydrogen had, but it doesn't have the proton anymore. And that is now an extra electron not countered by a proton, right? Which is why the whole thing is negatively charged. Does that make sense? Hydroxide, OH negative. The one in which the proton of the original hydrogen atom got added to becomes a hydronium ion, H3O plus. And it's positively charged because now you've added a proton to the whole mix without there being a counteracting electron. Okay? So this is autoionization of water because it happens automatically in a population of water molecules. This will be happening to a certain fraction of that population at any given moment. Importantly, notice that when this happens, you have to make both kinds of ions if all you have is pure water. You can't make one ion without making the other kind of ion if all you have is water molecules. Okay? Now, this is the basis for whether solutions are considered to be neutral, basic, or acidic. This is really what happens. Hydronium ions are formed, but actually hydronium ions don't stay as hydronium ions. They will lose the proton pretty soon after accepting it, which means that a proton can be on its own, which is still an ion, notice. Hydrogen ion. Now you can simplify this without the hydronium mention just by with a single water molecule. If you have a single water molecule and it loses the proton from one of the hydrogens, now you have that proton on its own, which is a hydrogen ion, H+, and the rest of it, which has that extra electron, is a hydroxide ion. Okay, so water ionizes into hydroxide ions, and you can call them either hydronium ions or hydrogen ions. It really referring to the same thing, even though they are different particles. Does that all make sense? But because you started with nothing but water, and you can't make one ion without making the other type, that means in a population of pure water, however many hydroxide ions there are, you have the same number of hydrogen ions, because you can't make one without making the other. And therefore, pure water isn't basic, or another word for that is alkaline, and it's also not acidic. It's neutral. Okay, now what scale do we use to measure pH? I mean, to measure acidity, and I just gave you the answer. It's the pH scale, right? pH scale is one of many P scales. The H of pH represents the hydrogen atom, hydrogen ion. But pH scales work a little bit differently from how you use math day to day. Any given P scale, but including pH, it's not a linear scale. It's a logarithmic scale. And most people are not really well practiced with logarithms. What is the logarithm of a number? It depends on what base you're in, but let's say base 10. The base 10 logarithm of a number is what? How's that defined? Well, the base 10 logarithm, since 10 is the base, the base 10 logarithm is the exponent that you would have to raise 10 to in order to equal that number. So, for instance, if I say 1,000, what is the base 10 logarithm of 1,000?
3.
3, because 1,000 equals 10, the base, raised to the third power. Okay? And the logarithm of 1?
0. 0,
because 10 to the 0 power equals 1. What about 1/10? Yeah.
Negative 1,
because 1/10 in fraction form can be written as 1 times 10 to the negative 1, right? Well, if you're talking about logarithms, whatever this is that you're raising 10 to is the logarithm. So the logarithm of 1/10 is negative 1. The logarithm of 1/100 is negative 2. Because 1/100 is 10 times 1 times 10 to the negative 2. See the trend there? But notice that every step in logarithm is moving the decimal place one place to the right or to the left. Which means, this is why it's not linear. In a linear scale, which a meter stick is a good example of, every increment is the same size. Every centimeter is the same size as every other centimeter. They're evenly spaced. In a logarithmic scale, even if you draw it so that they're equal sizes, like on the pH scale, every step is actually 10 times bigger than the step below it. Okay? If you go up 2 steps, then it's 100 times bigger than the one 2 below it, and so on. So that's one thing about it. It's a logarithmic scale. But P scales are also confusing to a lot of people because they are negative logarithmic scales. The reason P scales were devised is just to make it more convenient to deal with really small numbers. Really small numbers in scientific notation are something times 10 to a big negative number, right? Which you could write out over and over. But they said, if they're always going to be times 10 to some negative number, let's just dispense with writing that all out and devise a scale so that all we care about is the exponent of the 10. That's what a P scale is. Okay? In the case of pH, it's defined specifically as the negative base 10 logarithm of the hydrogen ion concentration, which you symbolize as H+ in square brackets. That means concentration. All right. Now, what else do you know about pH? The scale itself. Where would water be?
Seven.
And you might think, why in the hell did they ever pick seven as the middle of the pH scale? Well, that no one picked that. It's there not just because we chose it to be seven. It's there because of a property of water. Okay? So its pH is defined as the negative base 10 logarithm of the hydrogen ion concentration. If you have pure water, the autoionization that occurs, moment to moment, that's going to involve different populations, because remember, it's reversible. But if you were able to freeze time at any given moment, the vast majority of those water molecules would not be undergoing autoionization. They would just be neutral water molecules, like the ones on the left here. And a tiny fraction of them would be ionized. Okay? But it's a reliable, repeatable, measurable fraction or concentration of those water molecules that are ionized. And that happens to be, what do we use as units of concentration? I mean, there's multiple possibilities, but what have you learned about? Units of concentration?
Molarity,
which is, the units are molar, right? Well, for water, the concentration of hydrogen ions is 1 times 10 to the negative 7th molar. That's the reason that pH is centered at 7, not because of we wanted it to be, because that's what it's true for water. Therefore, pH of pure water is equal to the negative base 10 logarithm of 10 to the negative 7th. Well, forget about the negative logarithm. What's the positive log of 10 to the negative 7th? If you have something written as 10 to the anything, the log of that is that anything, right? Because that's the definition of the base 10 log. It's the exponent you have to raise 10 to get that number. So for 10 to the negative 7th, the log is negative 7. Therefore, the negative log of 10 to the negative 7th is positive 7. And that's why 7 is at the middle. Because pure water isn't basic or acidic, because there are equal concentrations of hydroxide and hydrogen ions. Okay? That's only true if you have pure water, though. Acids are substances that, when put into water, will dissociate into two pieces. A hydrogen ion, because acids contain hydrogen, at least by this definition of acids, and then everything else. Well, when the hydrogen ion from the acid goes into solution, you now have the hydrogen ions that came from the autoionization of water, right? Which equals the number of hydroxide ions. But now you have these additional hydrogen ions that came from the acid. So you no longer have the same number of hydrogen ions as hydroxide ions. Now you have a greater concentration of hydrogen ions. Okay, so one of the weird things about the pH is that it's centered on 7. I just explained that. Another thing that's weird about it is that when you go up in acidity, when you make the solution more acidic, you're going down in value numerically. Lower values below 7 are more and more acidic. But this makes sense according to the mathematical definition. Pure water has a concentration of hydrogen ions that is 10 to the negative 7th molar. What if you added hydrogen ions so that the concentration is 10 times that? What would the value be? Not of the pH, but of the value of the concentration. In other words, what is 10 times as high as 10 to the negative 7th?
Ten to the negative
6. Exactly. You're moving the decimal place over to the right one when you multiply by 10, right? So now it's 10 to the negative 7th is this. 0.000001. 10 times bigger than that is this, which is 10 to the negative 6th, right? You go up 1 from negative 7 to negative 6, just like you go up 1 from 2 to 3 when you go from 10 to 1,000. Everyone clear on that?
Yeah. You can say the same thing.
And so the log of 10 to the negative 6th, which is 10 times as concentrated in hydrogen ions as water is the log is going to be negative 6. The negative log is going to be 6. You go down from 7 when you increase the acidity. Above 7, you're making it more alkaline or more basic, because then the hydroxide ions outnumber the hydrogen ions. And bases are substances that, when introduced into water, split apart into a hydroxide ion and something else. The hydroxides are added to the ones already present because of auto ionization of water, and therefore you go up numerically on the pH scale to get more and more basic. But because these steps aren't equal, because it's logarithmic, that means when you go from pH 7 to pH 6, that's 10 times as many hydrogen ions. When you go from 7 to 5, that's 100 times more. Two steps, right? Two decimal place steps. And so pH of 1 is 6 steps below, right? That's 1,000,000 times more hydrogen ions than in pure water. 6 steps. So they're not equal steps. Okay, any questions on that? Slide 9 just gives you the scale itself. It's in most books, they would have the low at the bottom. I don't know why this book made the acids at the top, but notice that 0, 14. By the way, 0 and 14, there's nothing special about those. The special number is 7, because that's actually a measurement. But it doesn't mean that you can't go below 0. You can. A negative pH would be something that has a positive exponent here, right? Which is really concentrated with hydrogen ions, because it's greater than 1. Right? A pH of 0 would be 1 molar. You see that? Because it's 10 to the 0.
What would have pH?
You mean a real life example? Well, just a really, really strong acid. I don't have an offhand example, but the point is 0 is not the limit and 14 is not the limit. But most real things are within those, because those are extreme values. Well, speaking of values of everyday items that you know from your life, slide 10 puts them on the scale just to give you an idea of how acidic or how basic things are. Most of you, the cells of your body, are pretty close to 7, a little bit above, slightly basic. The vast majority of your cells can't tolerate even a small shift up or down in pH. That's why maintaining proper pH is an important part of your homeostasis. Your stomach is an exception, though. Your stomach is the most inhospitable place on your body for other things to live in, like bacteria that could harm you, right? And that's because the stomach continuously secretes hydrochloric acid, so it has a pH of 2 or lower, where the rest of your body would be killed by that. But it also, that is important in transforming molecules into effective digestive enzymes. That's why you have that acidity. But it also is nice that kills a lot of things that could do you harm, which is why you're continuously swallowing things, putting them into your stomach, where those bacteria, most of them will be killed by that stomach acid rather than harming you. Okay. Well, a real life example of what can really go wrong with pH is shown in slide 11. This is the effect of acid rain on a forest, and you can tell from the picture that this is not a healthy forest anymore. What is the big deal? Well, acid rain or acid precipitation, it can be snow or anything that falls, as long as it's acidic. Why is it acidic to begin with? Well, compounds that are released from industrial processes, or from diesel engines, for instance, have a lot of sulfur fumes. Other industrial processes spew out a bunch of sulfur. It's not just sulfur, but that's a good example of how this happens. Those sulfur compounds, when they mix with air and mix with the water droplets in the air, form sulfuric acid. So the rain is no longer neutral water. It's acid solution that's falling instead. And therefore, that affects the pH of everything that receives that rain, whether that's where the pollution was introduced or not, right? Because the air moves from place to place. Anyway, the reason that a change in pH is such a big deal to not just us, but trees and everything that relies on trees, is that it is because of something I've said a couple times already. Namely that proteins are involved in all important processes in cells. They do the work of things that need to be done in cells. And you have thousands of different kinds of proteins doing different jobs, but each individual protein does its particular job because of its shape. It's another name for the shape of a protein. Conformation. The conformation of a protein is what gives that protein its function. And without that shape, it won't be able to do its job. It'll be the same protein, it'll be the same string of amino acids, but it'll have a different three-dimensional shape and won't work as well. We call this change in shape, in response to some change in the environment, change in shape of a protein that's called denaturation. And there are two particularly important variables in the environment that can affect the conformation of proteins. Those are temperature and pH. Just a slight change, either up or down, in either temperature or pH can change the shape of proteins. And therefore, they can all of a sudden lose their ability to function for whatever they do, like being enzymes or whatever. And that can quickly kill an organism. This is why you put a lot of energy into maintaining proper pH and proper temperature, otherwise you would die quickly. Acid rain affects the pH, and that's why it's a big deal. So I think that's the last slide. Good timing. Any questions before I... Yeah, go ahead. Well, yeah, we are affected by acid rain because we rely on all the plants in that forest. We are consumers. As animals, we are consumers, which means we absolutely rely on producers, which the plants are. And when those start dying off, then the things that eat those die off. The things that eat the things that eat the plants die off, and we're part of that chain. But do you mean where our own physiology is changed by the acid itself? No, because we don't. First of all, we don't absorb that rain. We don't also stay in it. We don't live in it, and we wash off.
That's what I was trying to ask. Does it affect us, like, to the
top? It would if we were continuously taking in acidic rain. Yes, it would. Anything else before I stop the recording? All right, I'll see you Wednesday.